Hi, I'm Koshin Chris Kane, abbot of the Puget Sound Zen Center on Vashon Island, Washington. We're glad to be able to bring you these podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about our Zen Center, please visit our website at pscc.org.
It's a pleasure to sit with you all, and I'm very grateful for Koshin's invitation to talk with you. And now you know the truth. The real reason I'm out here is to see Sarah. It coincided nicely with an opportunity to be with you all. And I hope I'll be able to sit with you a bit more once I get a little clearer rhythm about how we're going to be out here. We're sort of a bi-coastal marriage. So about every 2 to 3 weeks, I'm on a plane for a long weekend, and occasionally when I get something like a fall break that I'm on now, then I can be out for a little longer, sort of relocate out here during the summer, I guess, is how we'll do it. So anyway, I hope to see you all again. So what I want to do this morning, and forgive my throat if it's a little ragged, I'm still surviving the ragweed assault on the East Coast, which is terrible. And it takes me 3 or 4 days out here to get clear of my allergies again. So, but what I'd like to do with you this morning is simply to invite you to reflect on a question, to invite you into a question that I have been reflecting on really since I was a child, though it took me 30 some odd years to mature consciously into the fact that this was a question I had been asking. And if the question is useful to you, then so be it. And I hope it gives you something to ponder. And if it isn't useful or doesn't land on you in a way that seems helpful to your own practice, then just practice your non-attachment and let it go. But the question for me is this. The question is, what is the meaning of my neighbor's faith for my own? What is the meaning of my neighbor's faith for my own? Now, I interpret the word faith there broadly. If you prefer, you can think of it as what is the meaning of my neighbor's religious tradition or my neighbor's spiritual tradition or practice. That's a broad sense in which I mean the word faith there. It's a question for me that's rooted in personal experience, but it's also a question that's being asked by people in various traditions who are engaged in comparative theology together. And it's also a question that can emerge simply from the comparative study of religions. For me, it's personal because I grew up with out in the country, south of Jacksonville, Florida, back when it was still country. It's not country anymore, it's all developed. And I grew up being raised by a grandmother, and I only understand the remarkable quality of this in retrospect. I didn't have the context to understand it when I was a child. But I grew up with a grandmother who had raised up on a chicken farm in Kentucky, in a Presbyterian church that is on the historic register today. It's about 30 miles dead south out of Lexington. And my grandmother's favorite singer was Mahalia Jackson, a great gospel singer. Her favorite author was Pearl S. Buck. And on her bookshelf, again, only later did I really come to understand the significance of this. On her bookshelf, you would find a bound volume of the Psalms. She loved the Psalms, particularly out of the Jewish prayer tradition. She had the Bhagavad Gita on her shelf. She had some writings by someone you may or may not be familiar with, Madame Blavatsky. Who is sort of at the roots of the theosophical movement in the United States. Some of you are nodding your heads and know who this is. Sort of a peculiar blend of her understanding of Buddhism along with some White Russian philosophy and all kinds of crazy things. But my grandmother had that on her shelf as well, as well as a sort of standard Jewish Christian Bible. And from my childhood, I was aware that while she attended the Episcopal Church with us, where I went when we grew up, that she was deeply interested in the spiritual questions that were asked from all of the traditions of the world that she was familiar with at the level of understanding that she had and that we had of those other traditions at that time in our history. So there are this personal root to this question, what is the meaning of my neighbor's faith for my own? Because I grew up Christian, but I realize now in retrospect, deeply mentored by this grandmother who had herself a respect for what the various traditions had to offer to one another. Now, modernity and even sort of theories of religion until the last 20 or 30 years ago have taught us to think of these traditions that we inhabit as different from one another, really in some ways sealed off from one another. And it is certainly true that in most of our traditions, Buddhist, Christian, Jewish, Hindu, we think of the teaching that we do and the learning that we do and the study that we do as a perfection and strengthening and formation of our growth in our own tradition that draws from our own sources. So if you're a Christian, you study the scriptures, and if you're Catholic, you may honor the magisterial teaching of the church, or creeds or councils or the teaching of a history of saints. If you're Buddhist, you study the sutras as well as have your sitting practice and engaging Dokusan, as you did this morning with Koshin, some of you. We think of the thinking we do within our traditions as drawing primarily, in fact only, from the sources of our own tradition. The problem with that way of thinking is that our religions, our traditions, our spiritual traditions, heritages, are not sealed off from one another in that way. Not in the origins of our traditions, and not in their histories. The Zen Buddhism you practice has influences and elements of Taoism in it, has influences and elements of second and third century Indian logical systems in it, as well as the aesthetics and rhythms of life and worldview that are present in East Asia. My own home tradition, the Christian tradition, really, if you track its development, it begins as a Jewish messianic sect that comes into Congress with the Greek mystery religions and the development of Greek philosophy at a certain critical point, the development of Neoplatonism around the time of Jesus and beyond. These are just two quick examples. If this were my classroom, I would subject you to much more detail for about an hour. The point is, the origins of all our traditions always are drawing from the riches of other traditions in which they are born. Furthermore, our histories of our traditions involve all kinds of opportunities for interaction with other, with different traditions than our own. Again, in my own tradition, so much of the theology of the Catholic tradition of the 20th century is indebted, notwithstanding probably 90% of Catholics don't know this, from a deep engagement between Jews, Christians, and Muslims around the Aristotelian Renaissance that flowered in two separate periods in the medieval era. tons of examples of this in your home tradition, in my home tradition, in every tradition, where we are, as one of my colleagues at Virginia Seminary likes to put it, located in traditions of bounded porosity. By which he means our traditions have their own integrity, their own ends, their own practices, their own ways of thinking and visualizing the world. And they are bounded in that way. There are centers and there are edges, but the edges are a little more porous than we often imagine that they are. And in many cases, sometimes interactions with other religious traditions along the way in the development of our own contributes significantly to the way we do our own practice. So this question, what is the meaning of my neighbor's faith for my own? And I give that question in a form I draw, by the way, to give credit where due, from the thinking of Anant Rambashan. He is a Hindu scholar of comparative theology, and he is the one who put the question in that way the first time I heard it put in that way. The question, what is the meaning of my neighbor's faith for my own, has a history and a practice and a long-standing reality that we do at various times in various ways learn from each other. What I want to submit to you this morning is that in a pluralistic context like our own, and we are, I think, the most religiously pluralistic nation in the world at this point. That's not an anecdotal observation, that's an evidence-based observation that comes out of the research of Diane Eck and her Center for Study at Harvard of World Religions. In terms of the range of spiritual and religious expression, the United States has a broader range and depth of diversity in religious practice than any other nation in the world right now. Not any East Asian country, not India or China, which might be the first places we would think of there, but the United States. In such a pluralistic context, it seems to me that this question, what the meaning of my neighbor's faith is for my own, is crucial not only for our tolerance of one another, our ability to live in peace with one another, but also goes to the riches that we might derive for our own practice by what we can learn from our spiritual other, our religious other, our other neighbor. It seems to me that this kind of cross-border learning both depends on, but also instills, at least these three gifts that I submit to you to ponder. The first is that it is a way of practicing humility before the mystery of the reality that we seek to engage ourselves with. Every tradition, every religious, every spiritual tradition, I'm roughly using those terms interchangeably, as you can tell. Every tradition has within it ways of recognizing the limits of our understanding of this deep reality with which we are engaged through our practice. Every religious tradition, including your home tradition, including my home tradition, recognizes that at some level there is an ineffability to this ultimate reality that we encounter. For the mystical traditions in Christianity, and in many ways for the whole of traditions like yours, the kind of practices that you see there are meant to reckon with the reality that we know and engage with the depth of the ultimate, but there are limits on our capacity to appreciate it. If that's true, then it might well be that the different ways in which my neighbor's traditions come face to face with the ineffability of the ultimate might deepen our own appreciation in our own tradition, our own capacity for respect for that ineffability. The second thing, it seems to me, that we engage with the possibility that our neighbor's faith has meaning for our own is that it gives us different questions to ask. I am one. This is a contestable argument that I am making, and there are people who make their living out of contesting it. But I am one who believes that the religions are best understood as asking different questions. It is the modern era that has taught us to imagine that what you do as a Buddhist, what I do as a dual practitioner Buddhist, what I do as a Christian, what the Jews do in whose house of worship we are graciously invited here. There's a way of thinking about that in modernity, that we're all doing exactly the same thing, and then the question is, who's got it right? But the reality is, our religious traditions are better understood as asking different questions alongside one another. The questions of the Buddha are not the questions of Jesus. Although we may find there are certain deep synchronicities that emerge when we look at those traditions lying alongside one another. For me, my own journey into Buddhism is the ground of my belief that we really are best understood as asking different questions and seeking different answers. I entered into Buddhist practice at a period of my life when I was coming to grips with the reality of a deep depressive anxiety that I was working with. And in a happy coincidence, or one might say providence in my tradition, or good fortune, I happened to be doing my graduate studies at that time and happened to land in a Soto Zen center, primarily as a research visit, because I was working with the comparative theology in my graduate study, and discovered there that the sense of non-attachment cultivated in Buddhism served well my own growth and movement into health out of the depressive anxiety that I was engaged in, which had all kinds of roots in it in my own family background. I've written about it. I won't take the time to talk about it here. But Buddhism addressed something that was driving my depression in a way that my Christian tradition didn't, at least not at that time. And it didn't mean there was anything deficient about my Christian practice or tradition. And I remained a Christian practitioner, even though I found myself ineluctably drawn into Buddhist practice at that point and never turned back from that and ultimately became a dual practitioner. But my Christian tradition shapes me in certain ways, and my Buddhist tradition shapes me in other ways. And there are synergies that emerge between the two, and there are commonalities, but there remain profound differences as well. And I submit to you out of my own experience that the second thing we learn by engaging our neighbor's faith as if it has something to teach us is that they may be offering approaches to questions that are not the major preoccupation of our own tradition. And we may even bring the learning of those questions into our own tradition along those porous lines of engagement I mentioned earlier that may deepen and enrich our practice in our home tradition. The third and final sort of gift I will suggest comes from engaging our neighbor's faith as meaningful to our own, is to say, and this is something that's really a heritage of learning from the deep monastic interfaith dialogue that has been going on since the 1950s, particularly among Christians and Buddhists, but some Hindu monks as well, some Sufi Muslims as well have been involved with this, even though Muslims don't have a monastic tradition per se. What you can see abundantly as learning from that five, six, almost now seven decades of interfaith monastic engagement is that in some way we are driven more deeply into our own practice and faith by seeing ourselves through an encounter with the other. These monks who have been involved in these decades of interfaith monastic dialogue regularly speak of the way that by sitting with a monk in a tradition other than their own, it throws a certain light by both complementarity and contrast on their own monastic practice and tradition, such that through the encounter with the neighbor, they come to understand themselves better and more deeply. Now, I would imagine, even hope, that saying that in a congregation of Buddhist practitioners would immediately ring some bells of familiarity, since along with the emptiness of the self, the co-arising of the self in interdependent engagement with all other causes is right at the center of Buddhist teaching. So that should be something that Buddhists would understand rather naturally to be the case, that there is some way in which our formation as selves, even as empty, non-essentialist selves, occurs deeply through engagement with the other. And so being open to the faith practices of another tradition gives us this gift as well, I think. This openness from the religious or to the religious other can sometimes lead to dual practice. It has in my own case. It doesn't have to. It can simply drive you more deeply to an authentic practice of your own tradition, seeing your own resources afresh in light of the encounter with the other. For some people, it takes them to a place of dual practice. Even when I am engaged in my own Christian practice as a priest in the Episcopal Church, engaging in the Eucharist, in the Mass and communion, in the eating of the sacramental bread and wine at the altar, I find now, after my long years of practice in Buddhism, that I approach the Eucharist differently. That when I receive the bread and wine, I think not so much that I am receiving a divine help and presence that's located there in the sacrament and then is coming into me, but that in fact there is a not-to relationship between the divine presence in the sacrament and the divine presence in me. So that my relationship to the Eucharist is a much more fluid interaction than it used to be. And that came for me through my Buddhist practice. Now, what's interesting is that in the Christian tradition, you can find certain teachers who speak of the Eucharist that way. Even the great Saint Augustine, who in several of his sermons and a couple of places in the Confessions said, particularly to the neophytes who were just coming to the Eucharist, "Do you see there that bread and wine that we're about to prepare for our altar practice? Do you know what that is?" I'm sure it was a rhetorical question if you were Augustine. "Do you know what that bread and wine is?" And of course, most Christians these days would expect him to follow that with something like this: "That is the manner in which God will convey himself to you through Christ in the sacred bread and wine." But that's not what he says. What he says is, "That is you. That is the mystery of you that you are to receive in the sacred body and blood of Christ. So become what you receive. Make your amen true." He meant the great amen at the end of the Eucharistic prayer. Now, I had read that in Augustine before I started Buddhist practice. But engaging in Buddhist practice enabled me to see there something that maybe Augustine meant and I didn't catch. Maybe it's something Augustine didn't mean, but I'm experiencing it in a different way, engaging with it differently, all as a result of the enrichment that comes from cross-tradition learning. So I leave you my own very brief version of my story here with the encouragement and the hope that you find riches in other traditions that enrich your practice in your own home tradition. And I commend to you the question that you might ponder, perhaps almost as a koan. Perhaps almost as a koan. What is the meaning of my neighbor's faith for my own?
Thank you so much, James.
Thank you.
I'd love to hear what you all think, if you have any questions for James or some thoughts that that brought up. I'd love to hear what Barry thinks as a dual practitioner. Barry, who, you know, we don't see that often, but except on the street I run into him all the time. He's one of my favorite people to run into. Has been a supporter of the Zen Center for so many years, 10, 12, 13 years, something like that, and is, of course, deeply involved with the Jewish community here. So thanks for coming. Did you come because you saw the title of the talk?
No, I came because it was a work
party. That's right. Okay, well, that was providential.
So my thought was we have Torah study every Saturday at 9:30, and it's a luminous kind of interpretation where. Next week, we're going to be doing the very last chapter of Deuteronomy before we start over with Genesis again, which is exquisite. And you're all invited. But we have two Mormons and one Catholic who are who love coming. And I think were you to try it once, you would love it too. And it would be a joy to have you attend, because the conversations would be endless.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, I've only been once, but I keep meaning to go back. I will do. Yeah, I won't this next weekend, though, because we've got a retreat we're doing here.
And talk about the riches of our neighbor's faith. The way in which Jews approach Torah study is one of the things I envy in Judaism, right? Some of you may know Barbara Brown Taylor's book or books. Recently, I think she has a book out now called Holy Envy, but the phrase is Christer Stendahl's, a Lutheran Swedish bishop, who recognized there was something healthy in the kind of holy envy we develop of the richest, most beautiful practices of traditions other than our own, right? And she cites Torah study and Torah argument as the thing that she envies and wishes Christians had in the way they approach Scripture. So, yes.
Just a comment on the Eucharist. I think the Eucharist needs to be understood in the context of the Passover.
Absolutely.
So when Christ says, "This is my body," it's the body of the teaching, and the symbolism of the Passover is so multiple. Mm. And the spirit of it,
it's another beautiful example of the interlaced origins we have, right? Not in the Gospel of John, but in the three synoptic Gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, that is presented as being a Passover meal when Jesus says these words over the bread and wine. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So I'm really interested in the part about asking how each faith helps you answer a question.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hearing that Buddhism was helping you answer the question of sort of, who am I and how do I work with my mind and my body? And what does Christianity help you answer? And some of the other traditions that you want to speak to?
Christianity, for me, nurtures deeply the sort of dependence on a power other than my own. Which, of course, is not unknown in Buddhism either. And particularly in traditions like Pure Land, you get even more of an emphasis on that. But I think for me, it is the nurturance of a deep sense of dependence that, as a dual practitioner after many years now, lies in very interesting, constructive, productive, occasionally contestational ways with my sense in Buddhism of the responsibility one takes for one's awakening. So they remain in this equipoise for me, and one pushes the other and the other pushes back. But anyway, from the Christian side, that's certainly, you know, one aspect of it. I think the other for me, and I'm an Anglican, there are different kinds of Christians as there are different kinds of Buddhists, but Anglican Christianity, the form of Christianity that flows out from the Church of England around the world, it's the Episcopal Church in this country, has long had a deep, deep affection for the incarnation, for the doctrine of the incarnation, and the full significance of what it would mean that the divine would see fit to be present in the materiality of the human. So in the Christian tradition, the deep reverence and use for fire, water, oil, bread, wine, cultivates for me a kind of wider vision of the whole of the material creation, the whole of the material world, as a place that is suitable, or in our tradition, you might say, to which God condescends to be present. And so the deep centrality of material signs as sacraments in the Christian tradition is probably the other thing that nourishes me most deeply from that tradition at this point in my life. Of course, the arc of our development changes, and other things have probably been more important at earlier times and maybe later.
Thank you for this talk. It's really, really interesting.
Thanks for having me.
I just realized towards the end that what was arising in me is my my judgment, which I'm not proud of religions based on how they are in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly, I just really, you know, have difficulty with other, with faiths, it could be Buddhist, could be anything, that sort of think that theirs is the way and everybody should see that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it, I'm thinking, I need to work with that. And because it's not helpful, it's separates, you know? It's
boundary.
And is that, I'm wondering if that's something that you have words of wisdom.
Well, I would maybe two things very quickly. One is there is commendable and reprehensible behavior in every religious tradition that is known to humanity. Buddhism, Christianity, Hinduism, Judaism is not a one that you can't find sort of aggressive isolationism or a disdain for the way of others, right? But funny, Christopher Stendhal came to mind a moment ago, because Stendhal had some rules for how we engage with religious traditions other than our own. And I'm not sure that I can remember all three or four of them, but one of them that always sticks with me is that when we're engaging with another tradition, we must always engage with the best of the other tradition and the best of ours. Rather than bringing the best of ours to the worst of theirs, right? Which is what we all kind of are inclined to do. So that's one thing is, you know, there are periods and practices in the Christian tradition that embarrass me. But there is also beauty and richness and openness to the other in the Christian tradition. And so I try to keep my eyes on the best and be rigorous about calling out the worst in some sort of charitable way. The other thing I would say very briefly is, you know, for reasons that I can partly explain and partly can't, it seems in many cases, I don't know that I've thought about this in respect to other traditions as much as my own home tradition, but certainly it seems to be true that often it's the worst of Christianity that gets portrayed publicly and most loudly. And what that obscures is that in Christianity, there are three, four, five different kinds of classical ways for Christian theologians to think about the value of our neighbor's faiths. And some of them are quite generous. I would place myself in something that scholars tend to call, for better or for worse, pluralistic inclusivism. That is to say, for me, it means that I recognize that in the terms of my own tradition, if God made the world, then God must be present and at work in all of the world's riches, including all the world's religious riches. Mm-hmm. Furthermore, if that's true, and here's where the pluralistic part comes in, there is probably something in my neighbor's faiths that I haven't figured out yet about God or ultimate reality that they can see and I can't, and my own tradition needs to sit at the feet of other traditions and learn from them as well. Now, of course, that's in Christian terms. So the language a Christian's going to use for that is that God is at work in some way in all those variant traditions. But if we consent to learning from others, as well as offering our own gifts, focusing on the best of what each tradition has to offer, then there is some chance that whatever we name this ineffable that we engage, that we are enriched in our engagement with it by honoring what is in the other as well. So all that to say, not all Christians understand Jesus as the way, the truth, and the life in a way that excludes what's going on in other Christian faiths. But again, for whatever reason, that side of Christianity doesn't seem to be as visible in the world, which is a shame. And maybe that's something we need to chew on, work on, figure out.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Puget Sound Zen Center. Thanks so much for listening. To learn more about our community, you can visit our website at pszc.org.